we need to see that red light there moving.
Engagements and public relations for Governor Nicotium. Although his official title is Administrative Assistant to the Governor for Communications, put that on a business card. He probably is best known as the Governor's Press Secretary. He's a native of Oregon. Now this is crossed out here. It says born blank years ago in Portland. He attended Grant High School, Pacific Lutheran University, and Oregon State University. Then he was in a sit down.
And he's going to.
Good heavens.
Hurry up or I'll lose them all.
Moving right along.
An original student staff member of the Oregon State University campus radio station. After graduating, 12 years later, he worked several years.
What did they say?
This is really wonderful stuff. Yes. First worked for Victor T in 77, and then in 78 was named Director of Communications. And most recently, he served as the campaign manager for the governor's re-election campaign. Then he's a member of the Society of Professional Journalists. He enjoys fishing, photography, and especially likes working with his computer. I'd like to introduce Danny Miles.
When Gordon first asked me to appear before CAMPRO, a couple of things went through my mind. I recall coming to my first CAMPRO meeting, you're right, I was a delinquent member. I have various excuses, but that will go over time.
Money isn't one.
That's right. You taxpayers just do keep me flush, there's no question about
that. You got it, baby.
Anyway, I recall coming to my first CAMPRO meeting, and I can't remember what year it was. Maybe some of the original members. But this is like over at the prime rib, and there was a larger crowd, quite frankly. So I think your goals in terms of coming back and getting some of the delinquents like myself, adding some more people, and so on, that was back in the McCullough days, in the very early days of CAMPRO. The other thing that was interesting was, Gordon says, well, Danny, I can't do a very good waiting, but Danny, he says, we're going to have installation of officers, and we're going to have... thank yous to all the officers. And so we really don't want a message per se. He says, just kind of funny and sort of, and I said, well, that's interesting. And he says, well, we got together and we thought, well, who could fit that? He said, well, obviously a press secretary could fit into that kind of load, nothing very substantive. Just stand up and say something for 20 minutes where you really aren't saying anything. And then he made the mistake of saying, it's not very heavy, just kind of light. And I said, Gordon, have you seen me lately? So in light of that, tonight's going to be kind of interesting. First time my wife said, I said, you want to go with me to the campground? And she said, are you going to give the same old speech? I said, no, as a matter of fact, it's brand new, because I've been asked to do something a little different. Going to give me the same old jokes, and I said, well, maybe one or two of the same old jokes. So I've got her here, and she'll hold up cards, 8, 9.5, went through the high and the low, and then go over there. So she just held up 2. Really, this is going to be a whole bunch of things about the governor's office and the governor's campaign that actually happened and that people really don't know about. Everything I'm going to tell you tonight is true stories. And Barbara, I'll be very interested to compare afterwards how many parallels there are between various governor's offices. Because I would venture a guess that while the details and the people might be a little bit different, that the actual storylines might be very, very similar. And so it'll be interesting to see. First of all, the first category of anecdotes or special stories, again, true. Strange, but true could be the title of this speech. The governor is very, very set on the word access and very, very set on accessibility. And he is a nut on it. That's one of my jobs, to make sure that conduit from the press or the public or whomever is open to him at all times. In fact, he is so accessible, sometimes the staff really kind of worries about it. There was a time, literally, that he was out on the front steps of the Capitol doing something, and a couple walked up to him and said, "Oh, you look like the yes, I'm governor to you. Oh, that's nice," and so on and so forth. He said, "Well, we really would like to meet with you." And so he literally set up an appointment with them for that afternoon. He later found out they were not from Oregon. They had never been in Oregon before. They were tourists, and they just asked the governor for an appointment and got an appointment with the governor. Now, that's access. That is truly access. There are holidays in the state of Oregon, as you well know,
yes,
that appear and happen on days when everybody else works, but state employees don't. Okay, those are the weird holidays. We're coming up to a series of, I think that Lincoln's birthday this year is going to be in January, the way they work it out. So it's close. I think it's February 6th. And of course, that's the day when the really good state employees come in and work. And in this case, the only really good state employee was the governor. He came in. Everybody in the outside world thought that state employees were working. After all, they were working, so why isn't the state working? Logical construct. So the phone is ringing. Ring, ring, ring. Again, Barbara, I'll bet you this had to happen in previous governor's job. The governor's the only guy working, and the phone is ringing. So what does he do? He moves his work out to the front desk and starts answering the phone. "Hello? It's the governor's office." "Well, this is governor's here." No, it really is governor's here. No, I'm not kidding you. And literally, half of the people did not believe that it was governor's here. And he had a stack of messages for everyone. And since that time, we have kind of a policy of rotating people through the front desk because it's a whole different experience than the governor can do it. Everybody. And if you're in your organization, and you're the boss, or you're close to the top, and you have not sat out at the reception desk for half a day, I invite you to do it. It's an excellent management. Another call, and this doesn't just happen on holidays. The governor will get a string of people. Everyone who calls the governor's office wants to talk to the governor. "I want to talk to the governor." "Well, what do you want to talk about?" "Well, I have this little problem with my street." "Or I still want to talk to the governor." He takes a certain number of those calls because, again, he wants to find out what's going on. So he got one guy, and he described him as being kind of raspy voice. He said he'd seen the bottom of a bottle often because he kind of had that real kind of head. And he said, "Governor," he says, "I'm in California." And he says, "I'd like to come to Oregon." But he says, "The problem is, you see, I've been arrested down here in California for driving while under the intoxicating liquids of some sort. And I can't seem to get away from California." And he said, "Could you extradite me to Oregon?" These are all truths of courage. And the governor says, "Well, in order to extradite him, you have to commit a crime in Oregon." He says, "Well, what crime would you like me to commit?" The whole business of getting a hold of the governor and this whole business of communication, because we have to get it, that tends to fall on my shoulders because I'm always the one who has to get an answer, yes or no, usually for some crazy radio station that's over here in the corner, or other similar radio station. There was one time, however, that a legislator, this was Tom True, during the property tax relief program, it occurred during the very end of the special session, and the governor had reached the compromise, they'd all come together, and he'd taken off to go to the McMinnville Chamber of Commerce. Had to give a speech. Everything was set, everybody agreed, everybody shook hands. Okay, Troop comes in, and he'll verify the story. Troop comes in and says, "I'm sorry, but the governor agreed to do this. And we said, "No, we were in the meeting. This. He said, "I understood the governor. It was a genuine misunderstanding." Well, the governor has just arrived in McMinnville, the Chamber of Commerce, and he's just walked up to the podium and started his speech. Well, the entire compromise of the entire 83 special session is hanging on having the governor talk to Representative Troop at that very moment. So we use the incredible powers of the state police, beeper systems and radios and microwave dishes, and we buzz the security guard, and we give him a note, and we say, "We want the governor now." So Lockhole Brooklyn, he's the governor's security person, writes a little note, hands it to the governor. He says, "If you're talking to the McMinnville Chamber like I am," the governor stops, picks it up. "Oh. Right now?" "Okay. Well, if all you people will just continue what you're doing, I'll be back in just a minute." And for the first time to my knowledge, an Oregon governor left the podium in the middle of a speech, went to the back of the room, got on the telephone, said, "Tom, I meant this. Tom said, "Fine, the compromise came together," and that's the story behind the 83 property tax relief plan.
What did he tell him when he came back? That's what
about. Yeah, what he told him was, damn it, I meant what I said the first time. I was going to leave that out. The governor, I try and figure out what he's going to say, because that's the press job, the press secretary's job, and I try and know him fairly well. But all of a sudden, I got, one day he was heading over to Warm Springs, and he stopped and he got interviewed by the Rajneesh Times. And the Rajneesh Times called up the wire services and it said, the governor has agreed to visit Rajneesh Puram. Well, in all the time that the Rajneesh issue has been around, the governor has said, no, he doesn't wish to visit Rajneesh Puram. And I should have known that, but no, it was, they were so positive. I mean, they actually called the wire services and they said, we've got it on tape and it's for sure and all that kind of stuff. And so I panicked and I said, I got to get a hold of the governor. Well, the story behind this is that he was going over to Warm Springs to do some fishing. And he had already left the main Warm Springs reservation, and he was already, in fact, several miles away, and I don't know if you can visualize it, down the Deschutes River, down the bottom of the canyon, up to about here in the Deschutes River, and his fly rod was working the Deschutes River, which, if you know the governor at all, is the only favorite pastime other than a hole-in-one kind of golf tournament that he might be in that he'd like to participate in. But Denny, again, using the resources of the state police and beepers and microwaves, sent out the word. Radio systems were down, and to make a long story short, they literally sent a Code 3 police car, because by this time the message had been garbled, and it was an emergency back in the governor's office. A Code 3 sheriff's car came screaming down this dirt road, got a hold of Lieutenant Holbrook, said, there's an emergency, you've got to get the governor up here immediately. And the governor, having a little more sense than most, said, Lon, will you go see what it is? Lon spends the next hour, it's not an exaggeration, getting up to a place where he can get a radio signal out of either the Dalles or back down to Mathis. Finally gets a hold of me. By this time, I've given up, and I don't really care whether I hear from him. He goes back to the governor and tells him what I want him for. He says, do you really want to go talk to Denny? And I don't want to say what the governor said. I had the great opportunity of working on the governor's campaign in 1978, and another great opportunity to be his campaign manager in 1982. A lot of stories about campaigns. Campaigns, Jenner, I could do a whole 20 minutes on just campaigns. But and some of them that are not very funny. Some of them are just kind of sad and scary in there. But for example, the scheduling error we made one time where we sent the governor from Sweet Home to Lebanon and then immediately back to Sweet Home before we sent him back to Eugene again, and he got done with that and called me up and said, do you understand where those two cities are? And I said, yes. He said, well, why did we do that? There was another time in the 1978 campaign where we got a news release that got out of hand, and a volunteer released a news release without my approval, and it got on the front page, and again, we're releasing stories here tonight that Nervin said publicly before the governor was thinking about dumping the entire campaign staff about a week before the election. It's a scary kind of thing in the business of politics. And there are, of course, better moments in a campaign than those kind of stories. Our campaign consultant in both the 78 and the 82 campaigns was a guy by the name of Paul Newman. And he, of course, was often confused with Paul Newman, right? He didn't mind that at all. He thought that was great. In fact, when he would register for hotels and motels, he said, it's Paul Newman, I'd like a room. I said, Paul Newman? The real Paul Newman? And of course, he thought of himself as being the real Paul Newman. He was incredibly creative, and in fact, we sat down on my very first day on the job, sitting in the Hilton Hotel in Portland in 1978, and we're sitting in the bar where most creativity occurs. And he says, you know what we need is a song. We need a campaign song. Let me think. And we created right there at that moment a campaign song, which started off this way. Tia, I once met a man named Tia. That's true story, though. I mean, it was that bad, too. We started growing. It helps to have had some scotch in you before you hear that song. Another first-time told story, and it's kind of fun to tell it with some people who, of course, work with and know Bob Straub, because this is a story that combines the two campaigns. And first time told publicly, as far as I know, there was a time when they were cutting a spot over Northwest Portland. And this was in the 78 campaign running against the incumbent governor, of course. And they spotted, number one, the car of the governor. And this is a bunch of campaign volunteers, and they go, well, it looks to me like a supporter of Victor Attia. So they pull off a bumper sticker and put it on number one. Yes. It's a wonder that they didn't get shot for doing that, because nowadays we have all sorts of controls in the car that you can touch it, it goes off and makes noises and sends signals to Salem and so on. But they did that. And my understanding was that it actually went unnoticed for almost a full day until they pulled up in front of the Capitol building and somebody noticed that there was an Atiyah bumper sticker. Now, is that a true story or is that a true story?
I think so.
Yes.
Dirty politics.
Oh, no. That's the only dirty trick that we ever pulled. Is, you know, the governor in the campaign environment is always asked to debate. In 1882, we had some debates with, of course, Ted Kulongoski. And the governor was portrayed as this plodding, quiet, dull, boring kind of guy. And they all said, you know, you're really foolish to get into this business of debating this guy who's really charismatic and good-looking and all this kind of stuff. And as you may recall, after the first debate, the headlines were, you know, surprise, Governor Atiyah, this, you know, this, and he just was lively, and boy, he really looked good, and Kulongoski looked nervous, and so on and so forth. And so we're back in the big Board of Control room in the governor's office, and we're sort of talking about this. And boy, that was great. You know, this, there was even somebody who said, you've got charisma. He said, he looks at us kind of surprised, says, you want charisma? I'll give you charisma. So watch out for Victor Atiyah when he starts getting into charisma. Favorite sayings of the governor. He gets into a series of wise sayings, and I won't go through all of them, but you may even hear some of these publicly. Terry might hear some of these, especially in news conferences. For example, there's two chances of that happening, slim and none, or that's just part of the great pageant of life. That's always said to staff members when they come in and say, but I don't want to do this, 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 and that. And he goes, well, it's just part of the great pageant of life. He also has a problem pronouncing nuclear. He pronounces it nuclear. And for a city club address one time, we had it in there five times. And so we said, well, all right, we're going to practice. Okay? Nuclear. Not nuclear. Nuclear. Okay, fine. Goddamn right. So as he would get to that word in the speech, he would be reading along, he would get to that word, he would stop, look down at the address, think about it, nuclear, and then resume the speech at the same normal rate. He did that for two times out of the five. When we got to the third one, he said, atomic power. Sawmill and so on, and so he's kind of trying to make conversation because when you've seen a saw and you've seen this, and so he's talking to this guy, and this guy said, yes, I spent some time in Oregon. Really, the governor said, no kidding, that's interesting. Well, what were you doing there? He says, well, I was a rug salesman. No kidding. Hey, you know, before I was governor, the governor says, I was in that same business. And the guy says, really? Well, then they immediately found this bond, you know. And so the governor says, well, what kind of rugs did you sell? And these guys says, all cedar rugs, Douglas fir rugs. Serious for just a minute, which says in effect that agency people need to be bold, they need to be innovative, they need to be not afraid to make mistakes. And so if someone makes an error, we understand that, and in fact we are going to actually reward them in some ways for some of their errors, because after all they were doing this because they were out front and they were pushing hard, and we understand that if you're going to push hard occasionally there's going to be a problem. Even the governor's name is on here, and I won't go through all of the winners except to tell you that probably the first winner was the most famous, and that was John Lobdell, for his famous quote before the Oregon Legislative Committee of, my job's tough enough, I don't have to take this boop boop from you guys too. Fred Miller is the current holder of the paddle, and he said he'd be glad to lend it to me. He's kind of embarrassed to have it in his office anyway. And so I thought I'd bring it and at least let you take a look at it afterwards. You're welcome to come up and see the great artwork on it. I've got to tell you about some of my mistakes in the office, because staff mistakes are sometimes the most critical. my first week on the job. And I was cocky. Boy, I tell you, week one, we were great. I was the press secretary, and I was great, and I knew everything. And I knew all that was going on, and I really knew how to handle the press. Martin Rosenberg of that time, the Capital Journal, called me up. And his line was, well, hi, Denny, how are you? Hi, Martin, what do you want? You know, ask me. And he said, would you give me any details about the resignation of Ron Ingram? And my response was, who the hell's Ron Ingram? And I heard in the background, Martin, what do I have to do to keep you from using that quote you just got? And he said, well, I need to have his resignation letter, and I need to have a quote from the governor, and I need it in 40 minutes for my deadline. I said, you got it! And I got it, and Martin was nice enough not to use that incredibly juicy quote. And of course, Ron Ingberg at that time had just resigned as the director of the state fair, and he reports directly to the governor, and I didn't know that, and I was really kind of flipped. And I've tried very hard not to be flipped to a reporter since then. That was an awfully good lesson. However, when reporters aren't around, I can still be a little bizarre. There was a recent vacancy on the Oregon Supreme Court, and in our office, people were just traipsing in. I mean, there was judges and attorneys, and everybody had to come in either to apply for the job or to tell the governor who they wanted in the job. So it was like for a solid week, attorneys and judges, just every time you walk out in the outer office, there'd be another one sitting there, and you'd recognize, I agree, Your Honor, yes, sir, and so on and so forth. And finally, Judge Bob Jones, who was a circuit judge, who eventually got the appointment to the Supreme Court, was sitting in the outer office and said, how are you doing? And I walked into the executive assistant's office. Now, I've got to give you a little feeling here that the executive assistant's office is right on the hallway, just a few feet away from the governor's office, and it's right on that pathway. And I go into Jerry Thompson's office, the executive assistant. I said, what's going on in this office? I mean, we've got judges and attorneys and stuff like that. I said, you know, it's kind of like, you know, here comes the judge, here comes the judge. At that very moment, Bob Jones is walking by the front door of the office. He does a big take and looks in at me, and I look back out at him and kind of wave, and he walks on by. Luckily, he did get the appointment, or I would really be worried. Finally, the only other mistake I made, these are only three in 5 years. The only other mistake I made was early on when we failed to update the governor's introduction material. And as a result, he gave a speech right after the election, and the stuff we sent him says, you know, Senator Atiyah, a few mistakes like that. And so the person who was introducing the governor, instead of making, you know, corrections that everybody knew, he took it and said, well, gee, Governor, your staff sent us this thing. I don't know about it. He, of course, did about 20 minutes on this out-of-date introduction material. The governor was just kind of sinking lower and lower in his chair, and I'm sitting in the audience listening to all this, trying to disappear. The governor stands up and he says, well, I do want to introduce some of my staff, my former press aide. Well, finally, a couple of stories that are maybe a little more recent. The 1983 special session, which we talked about earlier regarding the phone call to McMinnville, that was a session in which the press, and Terry knows this, just hovered outside the office because we're meeting with leadership and there's tension and the leadership comes out. And you try and get anything you can out of any member. What happened? What did they say? Has there been any movement toward a compromise? Because they were hanging on every meeting. And we probably had six, seven meetings. Every time there was a meeting, you'd go out and the camera lights would come on and the reporters would start rolling. And anybody who was willing to talk, it was great. Well, and nobody, of course, wanted to talk because we hadn't reached a compromise. Finally, there was a conclusion to the meeting. The governor had finally decided what he was going to do, and we went rushing out, and there was absolutely no one there. They were all down in a hurry. And the governor turned around to the ceremonial office, and he said, they're not here. And he looked back at me, and he said, but I had something to say. The legislature, but down in the revenue hearing room was where everyone was because there was a hearing down there, and they were getting bored with people coming out of these meetings and not saying anything, so they weren't hanging around anymore. And I went downstairs, I said, give me 2 minutes, Governor, and I went running downstairs to the revenue hearing room, and I started walking from reporter to reporter. I said, the governor's holding a news conference in 1 minute. Does he have anything? Yes. And they started packing up their cameras. And I walked to the next person. The governor's going to have a news conference in less than 1 minute. They started packing up their stuff. I emptied that entire hearing room because all the camera people started to leave. Then all the lobbyists started to leave. The legislators adjourned the hearing and came upstairs to see the news conference. One story that does involve our friend T.L. here, who helped me out one time with the governor. The governor goes to Hawaii every year. That is his vacation. He takes 2 weeks, goes to Hawaii, doesn't take any work with him. This year, barely got to his golf clubs. And he really does tune out. I mean, we try not to call him and even keep him informed because it's a time that he really is able, the only time of the year, to get a true vacation. And so he was getting ready to head back from Hawaii. And I said, you know, look, the guy's got a good sense of humor. You gotta go take a joke. So what can I do? Well, I had been building projects in my basement. And this is a very small, very short distance FM transmitter, which you can plug into a tape recorder and transmit onto anyone's FM radio. And the governor listens to an FM radio all the time that he's in the office for background music. So we tuned this to the station that he listens to and installed this next door to his office. And we plugged a tape recorder into it. And then Terry and I did a tape. And needless to say, that tape started off sounding very realistic and ended up with me selling the governor right down the river. I mean, I realized people are questioning what the governor did. And it was kind of bad, but you know, it wasn't that bad. The governor bought it for literally a solid minute before we finally broke up. The people who were in the office listening. And the only problem I have tonight is I searched, and Terry, we're going to have to find that tape to come back to Camp Row and play that group. That was the penultimate story as far as the governor's office is concerned. You got the tape, Okay. Well, anyway, that is a short version of some of the anecdotes, at least the ones that I can tell. There are a few others, and I love to come back sometime as a full-fledged Camp Row member and update you as to any other possible stories that may have happened. I do appreciate being able to be here and not have to talk about the theory of public relations or give some of my old jokes that my wife has heard time and time again. And remember, it was all true, strange, but true.
Central mansion is the observatory. It goes around the outside, like Italian marble. It was this kind of beautiful marble, but also in the center party line logo were composed of those same kinds of the same kinds of marble, which is why the world of reading is why now the text is in marble. Why go out to the quarter if you can move south about 30 miles, take a car more and chop it up. Alright, these mosaics, these are the mosaics as you look in the direct into the choir area. In the center is the Agnus Dei, which is the Lamb of God, literally the Lamb of God. This is symbolic, again, of the figure of Christ this time, wholly seen symbolically as a shepherd. His identity is referred to not only by his placement in the choir, but also by the nimbus, by the halo that surrounds him. And these two slides, and this is closer to the color, this is much closer to the color. The colors are much richer, not quite as bright as you see over there, much richer, but even at that, we can see this wonderful play of vegetable matter. Four archangels, Michael Gabriel, the four archangels, right, four winged archangels that hold up this reed that contains the Lamb. And you can see how they, how the vegetable matter, which comes to us, again, from Roman decorative vocabulary, how that's being played with here. So that the golds here become the greens, and the green background becomes the gold. And then it varies, left to right. Wonderful decorative, highly, ornamental, and decorative bias infuse them with this wonderful sense of color. There's never been these mosaic schools that can match those of Ravenna and the first building. It's never. In terms especially the polychromy. Along the sides of the walls are some symbols, more symbols of the evangelists, including the symbol of Mark. Alright, then in this area, these front each other right across the choir are other biblical scenes, other Old Testament scenes here. Abraham and the three angels right here. He's serving them meat, and this is really a Chopin device, instead of showing a slab of meat. Abraham brings a little cow, sent to serve the angel, and they're there with the bread. Over here is the imminent sacrifice of Isaac by Abraham. And of course that story turns out all right. Abraham is proved. God, the Old Testament God plays hardball, all the time. He's a real tough nut to crack. And so Abraham was out to prove his love of God, of course, superseded his love of everything else, was called upon by God to sacrifice Isaac, his beloved son. And he was willing to go through with it. And as soon as God sees he's willing to go through with it, he stays his hand. You'll see in Renaissance arguments term how he stays his hand physically, will reach out to God's hand. In this case, it just makes a gesture again from the clouds. The hand comes down. And Abraham looks up with some relief, and I think so does Isaac. With real relief, not some relief. And you can see again this typical Byzantine device of separating these series of biblical events from ordinary events by this kind of stage, this platform sort of up there. Transitional here, there's Matthew, there's the eagle, John. I'm showing you these details because they show you that you can't get these anyplace else. And from your text, you really see how the mosaics work in these details in a way you can't out of sort of general pictures. Which is too bad. A mosaic in these texts just looks like so many outlined forms. A little rock and roll food, even that. And of course, they're anything but the final one that is Luke, the ox. Okay, and off to the right is the sacrifice of Abel and Melchizedek are making sacrifices. And again, you can see their name, Abel and Melchizedek. And the hand comes down, and the sheep is about to be offered on the Eucharistic table. Typical Byzantine shorthand devices and using these. A little bit of architecture to stand for an entire building, for scale, for a different unit at all. Now, as you move past the choir, you move back into the apse area itself. Okay? And these are the figures. This is the retinue. This is Justinian, the emperor himself, in the center here, surrounded by his, as I said, by his retinue. Pardon me? Well, yeah, he is the emperor, so he has a secular right to wear the purple, which is still obviously identified as the emperor. Christ wears the purple. article two, which says in Helios, at least as P of the world, P of the heavens. But sure, Justinian wears the purple. Yeah, obviously he's wearing the purple right there. Well, here he is, and as I said, he's surrounded by some people we can identify as a matter of fact. Here's Maximius, who was a bishop when the cathedral was being built. Maximius, nearly a portrait, bald head, and was across the forehead. You might have looked, must have looked something like that. It seems to be such a close portrait. Very unusual to be that specific in terms of a physical, orientation. Off to the right is the general that conquered the Italian, reconquered the Italian peninsula. Belisarius is his name, for Ravenna. And then surrounding them are a series of nondescript characters, his guard. And again, that sort of clustered head of the device we're looking at before. The clustered head device which stands for a large number of people. The cluster head device here, though, is used to extol the virtues of Justinian, too, at least his world and life. For instance, if you count, and you have to do this sort of carefully, the head cluster, you find there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 people in the head cluster. Then you continue to count 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Justinian has, in fact, surrounded him by 12 people. This is Justinian. Of course, identified himself, at least in a modified kind of way, with another individual who characteristically was surrounded by 12 people, which can only be, numero uno. It's sort of the height of egoism, in a sense, on one plane, one level at least, to have him surrounded by 12. It's also probably a reference, again, to the extremely important role of the emperor played in the Orthodox Church. In the Western states, it's traditional, of course, for the secular leaders to be separated from the religious leaders. The Pope is a primarily religious leader. Then there are emperors under the popes. Of course, he was also in charge of secular activities in the areas that he was in control of. But still, the emperor was something separate from the religious leader. And that's not true in the Greek Orthodox Church. That the emperor was very closely aligned with the church, with the patriarch of Constantinople. The gold background also emphasizes the religious nature of it. Highly symbolic. The figures are long, elongated. They have a kind of regal stature. I think it comes directly from the fact that they are shown, in this very elegant kind of fashion, not only in terms of drapery, but in terms of mentality, poise, if you will, and these very long figures. They're not, in other words, like the short dwarfy little figures that we saw, for instance, Santa Maria Maggiore, those mosaics. Something entirely different is going on here. Something very elegant, very quiet, very serene. There are mistakes, though. Not mistakes, actually. It doesn't matter. This is where if you count the feet, you've got 13 people, you need 26 feet. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19. You've got 19 feet. You're sitting yourself. Sorry. What's going on here? Well, the point is, of course, it just doesn't matter. It doesn't matter at all. Pardon me? No, well, that's the point. And of course, it doesn't matter when your premise is not visual. Your operating premise is not visual. Sorry, the colors in this are not quite as brown, colors in this are not quite as blue. You have to sort of vacillate. Find a median. Now, that's a pretty true color right there. There is Maximian. Okay. Now, the intrigue of this just gets even more interesting as you cross the way. Theodora, historically, might be parallel to the historical role she was playing, might be parallel to that of Nefertiti in the fact that she is, in terms of textbook orientation, such as gaining more important political role. Theodora is his wife. Here is Theodora. We know Theodora's background. Theodora was the daughter of keeper of theirs in Hippodrome, Constantinople. And Justinian found her and admired her beauty from afar as she performed in what is euphemistically called a stage in Byzantium. These are the areas right around the Colosseum. As I said, euphemistically called a stage. It was a house, right? A house that Justine frequented, apparently, you know, with real zeal. At any rate, she made a connection with Justine in this house. Rose the enormous power, so that at a given point she may have made her the empress of the world, essentially. Constantine, this is the golden age of Byzantium. And here she is, when she traveled, she went outside the country, she traveled with 4,000 people in her party. No less than 4,000 did she need to attend for specific kinds of needs. One of the things we've lost, really lost, you know, from the first golden age, are the textiles. There's an art history of textiles as well, and we get just these glimmers of what the textiles must have been like in part of the retinue that follows, just follows the silks and the golds, the variation in the garments, extremely high quality, you can glean from these pictures. And then Theodora herself is decked out in lovely costumes. And elegance. Well, all right, now she stands. This is actually is amazing enough. She is set in exactly the same position as the imagery, 50 apps across from Justinian, right? They're right across from each other. But then Christ, if our alignment is struck like this, and I'm standing in the place where Christ stands, right? At the back of the apps like this, okay? Justinian would be here, and Theodora is actually one person farther in. If you're crossing them like this, this cannot be accidental. What that does, in fact, is place her one person closer to Christ, the image of Christ behind her. You can read a lot. Yeah. Because she also, carries the nimbus around her head. There are other things here which are interesting, too. For instance, now she can't have 12 people around her. There's no identification, of a female with 12 apostles. But embroidered on her cloak end here are three fellows who seem to be bearing gifts. Right here. The three fellows, of course, can only be the three wise men, and who do they bear gifts to? They bear gifts, of course, to Mary, mother of God, and the Christ child. So, in a sense, in a number of ways, she seems to one up Justinian on the other side. Real interesting historically as well as fun. They're both the same thing as far as I'm concerned. History is fun. There are other stories that revolve around Theodora, and the most important for the history of the Byzantine Empire concerns the 532, the so-called Nika riots, N-I-K-A, the Nika riots. We set the stage for this. There were factions in the Hippodrome, the Greek Colosseum, where these bloodletting events were still going on. You just transferred the events from the Colosseum. Rival factions, and they identified themselves in terms of colors. So there was the greens and the reds. I've forgotten the colors, but I think greens and reds are right. And on one sunny afternoon, at least on one day, they rioted. They clashed and they rioted, and the riot spread throughout Constantinople. It was like the French in '68, the students rioted in Sorbonne, and then 3 days later, the whole country was shut down. One thing leading to another. And the very fabric, the very structure of Byzantine society was under threat. The palace itself was under attack by the mob. And as the story goes, and this is from a contemporary chronicler of these events, that Justinian is ready to take off for a summer home in Yugoslavia. And that it was Theodora who stopped it. Diocletian, he got a summer home in Yugoslavia. We don't think of Yugoslavia today as the best place for some reason. There's a nice coast there, and beach and stuff. She said, I think I read about the fact that I've written down, but I'll paraphrase it. She said something to the fact that I'd rather live in the purple than die. I'd rather die in the purple than to live in the white, something along those lines. Which referred to the fact you'd rather die empress than to live as anything else. And this statement, this her personality, what have you, rallied, encouraged troops. They corral about 5,000 of the rioters in Pipico, and they slaughtered them to a person, and that effectively put down the riot. Usual look. So anyway, she develops as a historical character. We can see, I don't know, even Miss Mosaic, I think perhaps you can read some of the force of his personality, risen from the lowest kind of beginnings to rise to the heights of knowing the world, as the heights of knowing. Here's a portrait of the church. Size, which we don't get a relative comparison here, is that quite as dramatic as it is in situ as a site, in sight. It has the same kind of disorientation as kind of orientation as the we saw with the Good Shepherd Mosaic at Dalla Pacitia, and we also saw with the legal and Melchizedek separation. Four rivers of paradise here flow from the gold to blue or
that is
a blue model of the Sandwich College, of the church, this actual church. The church was begun under Maximian, who stands to the right of Justinian, just below. But the church was completed under Ecclesius. Maximian died, Ecclesius came in, so it was, he was the bishop of record, I don't know. And then, of course, Christ sits. Look at this, for instance. This is just marvelous how the deep blue sphere give way to the lighter covers, which intend to accentuate that Christ is then in this, completely covered with the purple, robe, and then this fantastic sky, the setting sun. It's the orb of the heavens, and it symbolizes the world, this world, celestial world. Christ has, besides the cross, and a nimbus behind it, a halo is something that's a little circle. A nimbus is a big circular platform that stands behind the head like that. There are lots of other attributes. You'll find Christ in something called an almond-shaped thing like this, called an angora, which also is a separating kind of device that symbolizes divinity. And the blue orb is one of those. It's one of those.
What's the symbol of
the orb? Oh, this is the letter Z. It's the letter Z. It's the Greek Zeta, which stands for Greek word for life, Zoe, and it stands for life, Christ is life. It's a symbol, it's still being used. Maybe some of you saw the movie Z. This movie. I don't know if that comes over a bit of it. You've got to see it. It's dated somewhat, but it was about the Greek generals and the suppression of a pacifist movement in Greece. But it's about tyranny, about local tyranny. And it's a marvelous movie. It's a French movie made about a particular political situation in Greece called Z. And the way they kept this murdered pacifist alive, in their minds was to write Z on the streets and on the walls. It was a sign of subversion. Like a fish. Exactly the same thing. Where's Zorro come from? I don't know. It makes the sign of the Z. Zorro. What? If you're on the table or something like that, you might get a chance to see it. Here it is, just again, another slide, just the detail I have, saying the college. It's marvelous. It's a peacock, the symbol of immortality. Maybe the peacock should stand as a symbol for Sandy College. The colors in this are real true. These are all remembered. Controlled lighting situations. Beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. I think in deference to the vacation, maybe it's about time to stop. I don't want to get started on this building. When everybody comes back, they want to see it too. Let me just set it up and then we can go on. We can stop. The Sanders Hall in Ravenna will always be, in terms of mosaics, the home, the center of the first golden age because of the survival. But architecturally speaking, buildings can survive, but mosaics did not survive in the first iconoclastic period, 726 to 843, the Church of Hagia Sophia, the Church of Holy Wisdom, Hagia Sophia, in Istanbul, still stands as one of the great buildings of the world, four, five great buildings of the world. We have to think away things like the Turkish minarets here. Those are obviously after Islam. Think those away. And when we start next time, we'll look at how in one building only, see the perfect fusion of the rotunda and building heights in this one building, and also get some idea as to how far you can push this magical interior effect, the great aura of mystery, in terms of the way that you control the lighting as it comes into the interior. This mishmash of an exterior, like even the plain unadorned brick buildings of Ravenna, do not give you any idea of the unity of the interior experience of San Vitale, and of Ravenna, of Hagia Sophia. So let's start with Hagia Sophia up in Constantinople, Istanbul, in the Sea of Marmara, after vacation, I guess, on Monday. After Turkish, Constantinople was the first Constantine, the Christian emperor, so after 1453, for example. 1453. Yeah, I'm not sure exactly.